Hello and welcome to A Listing's Tales from the Script. I'm Tom Moore. Today, my special guest is one of the founding members of A Listing, and she performed this upcoming story at the Storytelling Centre with Joe Caulfield in a new monthly show called Speakeasy. Here is Ariadne Casmaran with Dog Biscuits.
When they exploded the bomb in the middle of the desert, they warned the farmers to evacuate, and the miners, and the scattered settlements. But because they counted the aboriginals, whose land it really was, as animals, they didn't tell them, so they died. When the blast settled and the scientists went out to clean up and count, they found kangaroos and lizards, wombats and dingoes, and men and women and children. They put them all on the same heap. This is a true story. I grew up without underpants. Sometimes I also had no food and had to make do with dog biscuits. It's not that my parents were cruel. It's just that we were poor and they were careless. We lived in the middle of nowhere, in a region we called the Never 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 Land. Until the age of 10, I had never seen another child. I didn't know there were other children, or even that I was one. I didn't realize having no underwear was a particular source of embarrassment, to be honest with you. Here were some of the things I was aware of, though. I was thirsty a lot, and I didn't have a choice. Anyway, one day my dad said to me, "We don't have any food. Why don't you go out and look for some?" A pretty new suggestion for me, and one I was a bit wary of. "But Dadda," I said, "how am I going to find food out there?" He said something about trying my best. Then I saw he was about to cry, and then a tear actually slid down his cracked and leathery face. What a waste of water. I knew him for what he was then, a sissy. All faith in him dashed out. I agreed that going into the desert to look for food was a good idea. I took a big bottle of water and some dog biscuits and went. A few hours later, I saw a flash on the edge of the earth, so bright and horrible that I thought the world was ending. It was, obviously, beautiful to see. When it was gone, the ground under me seemed a bit darker and the sky looked upset. The birds weren't singing and the trees weren't stirring. It was as though the world had been punched and was winded and couldn't get up. I learned something very important on that quiet, crushed day. I was shit at catching food. When it got dark, I was surrounded by animals, but I was too scared to do anything about it. 3 days later, with just a dribble of water left in my bottle, lost, and I'll not lie to you, doubting my parents' wisdom, I met the red-headed boy. The red-headed boy had no shirt. He was the palest thing I'd ever seen. The sun bounced off him and blinded me. He had shoes, which I was jealous of pretty much instantly. I picked up a rock and threw it at him. It missed. Then he said, "Ay!" and began to chase me. One thing I am really good at is running, so we ran a long way with him saying, "Ay!" and throwing rocks at me, till eventually we came to a hollow under a pile of rocks. Three of his stones had hit me, and I threw up my hands and told him to stop. He was angry. He wanted to know what I was doing. I said I was looking for food. He said I must be lying because he was looking for food. Some time later we got tired of arguing and I believed him. It was weird. I hadn't known, you see, that there was anyone like me. "Are you poor?" I said. All the fight went out of him then. He started crying, which made me throw a rock at him again, but he took no notice. He just sat down in the dust and cried. It made me think about my dad. "You're wasting water," I told him. We went to sleep cuddled up together in the hollow that night. The next morning he woke me up, shaking me and yelling. There was something over the rocks. I went up with him over the slippery leaves, past the sleeping snakes. When we got to the top, we saw the house. It was like no house I'd ever seen. It was made of food. The red-headed boy ran down to the house and began to bite it and bite it. I was frozen watching him. I'd never seen so much food before, but it didn't make me feel hungry. It made me feel sick. It was made of minties and Tim Tams and violet crumbles and cherry ripes. I came down and touched the house. It was cold. The chocolate wouldn't melt in the middle of this desert. I started to wonder what it would be like inside. The boy broke off a Tim Tam and gave it to me. Because I'd only really eaten dog biscuits until this point, I'd never had one before. When I ate it, I couldn't believe it. It was the first time I'd ever been able to not believe something. That's how good it was. Then the door opened, and this horrible old woman came out with her arms outstretched, smiling. We jumped out of our skins, because she had no eyes. The old woman was saying, "Come here, my dearies," but we said, "Nah," and we ran all the way back to the hollow. The next day and the day after that, we snuck back to break little pieces off the house. But on the third day, she caught us. She came up behind us with a fishing net, sniffing us with her big hooked nose, and bundled us inside. The red-headed boy was screaming and kicking. I was lying still and floppy. When we got out of the net, he went crazy, running around, trying to climb out of the windows, bashing into the doors. I just sat down on the floor. The old lady took him by the arm and squeezed it till it turned purple, right down to the fingers. When she chucked us into a cage made of bones, I went easily. I felt okay, because I still had dog biscuits in my pocket. That night the red-headed boy was snivelling and starving. I offered him a biscuit, but he said, "Yuck." Every day I ate a little bit of biscuit. Although I offered it to the boy, he always stuck up his nose. One day I said, "What are you going to do to us, old lady?" "Nothing," she replied. "I'm going to let you starve." "Why?" I said. "Don't you know children are delicious?" Well, she said she hadn't considered that before. All her experience had taught her was that children were constantly coming up to her house and eating it, which was really annoying. "Little boys are especially tasty," I said. Then I sat back and said nothing else for a few days to let her think about it. Soon the red-headed boy was stuffing his face. He didn't even say thank you. It didn't matter. It didn't even matter when he didn't offer me any. I was biding my time. When the old lady let us out of the cage, she felt us up. She ran her bony finger up and down my ribs. Then she did the same to the red-headed boy, but she couldn't find his ribs. He was as fat and luscious as a pig. She roasted him up and ate him while I sat quietly. While she was sleeping, I opened the door and walked away. You might be thinking, why wouldn't you kill the old lady and then stay and eat Tim Tams forever? Well, I was biding my time. As I walked through the desert, I saw dead animals everywhere. The lizards and snakes, the possums, the kangaroos and rock wallabies all lay still. And I saw men and women and children, all black people, and they were dead too. I walked for 2 days, and at the end of it I was thinking about picking up one of the strange dead animals and eating it when someone tapped me on the shoulder. Standing there was a man and lady in white coats. They said, "Don't eat the animals. They're full of radiation poisoning. There's been a bomb." I said, "Oh." They had meant dead animals. I told them about the dead people, but they didn't seem very interested. They asked me where I lived, and I told them. They were amazed. They knew my parents. They were the stupid people who refused to evacuate. Just before I got into their jeep, I dropped my last dog biscuit. At home, my parents made me a cup of black tea with lots of sugar in it, which wasn't extravagant. The next morning, I took them by the hand and I walked them to the spot where I was picked up by the dead animal counters. Then I began to follow my trail of dog biscuits. When we found the house of Tim Tams, my parents were amazed. They ran right up to it and began to eat it. They had chocolate all over their faces and they were laughing. They were so excited. They didn't see the old lady when she snuck up on them with her big nose sniffing. She threw the net over my parents, and as she bundled them inside, I said, "You think little boys are delicious. Wait till you try grown-ups." A week later, the old woman was dead because my parents, who were full of radiation, had poisoned her. I went and sat in her house. I dragged the body outside. Then I went back inside and began to eat. I ate the whole house. It didn't take me long. I was hungry. Then I began to wander the world, and when people ask me where I'm from and what defines my country, I say rat cunning. To be honest with you, I now doubt my own wisdom. I never ate another piece of sugar again after that. Nothing has replaced the cavity my parents left in me, and the only thing that really satisfies are dog biscuits.
That was some dark shit. All right, then. So tell us a bit about that story and what inspired you to write it.
Okay. Well, partly It comes from a huge amount of Australian post-colonial guilt. A lot of the stuff in that story was about a true event in the 1950s when the British did nuclear testing in the middle of the desert, and a lot of Aborigines died in the process and really were counted in those days with the animals because they weren't considered human. Part of what I was trying to do with that is to tell that story, and a lot of Australians tend to shy away from telling that kind of story. It's not something people are very comfortable with yet. I think Australians are still in that denial state where they're making racist jokes instead of facing the horror full on or really trying to do anything concrete about it. So I think that story was a very deliberate attempt to try and tell a story about it.
Okay, and the sort of fairy tale elements, kind of obviously Hansel and Gretel theme, and there's a lovely thing actually. Fairy tales often have these kind of tricksters, and there's quite a kind of trickster theme with the narrator being incredibly sinister and twisted.
Yeah, well, partly it was a desire to kind of play with that dynamic between, the two children and the crazy old woman who wants to eat them. I wanted to play around with the villain, who is the villain of the piece. And it turns out, of course, to be the little girl. And much as she has the motivation behind it to really kind of back it all up, she's a little beast. So yeah, I love Hansel and Gretel. I love the darkness, and I love that it's about abandonment and fear and loss. And to a certain extent, it's a story about childhood and that loss of control when you are stuck in the cage of bones, with a mentally unstable grown up who might eat you at any stage. And sibling rivalry and all that stuff. Hansel and Gretel is about an awful lot of stuff that resonates with anyone who's ever had brothers or sisters, or indeed mental parents. So yeah, there's an awful lot of stuff that's really fun to play with Hansel and Gretel.
Slight aside question, what are Tim Tams?
Okay, so Tim Tams are these amazing biscuits, right?
Right.
I think the closest thing you'd have to them in the UK are penguins. Penguins are made with really inferior chocolate and they're really cheap and nasty.
Don't
But
slag off penguins, I love
penguins, yeah,
penguins.
I know, man, and I love penguins too. When I can't get hold of a Tim Tam, the penguin is my backup Tim Tam, but it's just not as good. Tim Tams are amazing, especially if you put them in the freezer and then you bite off a bit at one corner diagonally and then you suck your coffee up through the Tim Tam and then you end up with a Tim Tam explosion and you're looking really grossed out now, and that's fine.
I'm imagining you biting into your Tim Tam and the Tim Tam explosion. It doesn't help that I can only picture it as a Twinkie, and I've never had a Twinkie, but it's like a kind of cake-filled cream thing. And
No,
oh,
it's infinitely more
okay.
disgusting than a Twinkie. Oh, so much better. No, Tim Tams are brilliant.
Okay, right. Moving on from Tim Tams, slightly sidetracked there. Okay, development as a writer. What's the first thing you can kind of remember writing? What are the first things you can remember writing?
Oh, I wrote an awful lot of bollocks, Tom.
Did we all?
I wrote poems a lot when I was really little, because when you grow up in the Australian curriculum, they feed you an awful lot of bush poetry. Bush poetry is poetry that rhymes, and it was by people like Henry Lawson and Banjo Paterson. So it all rhymed, and it was all this really uniform stuff. And it was written while Australia was being developed, so it's sort of while this poetry was being written to fill up newspaper inches, it was a kind of self-mythologizing of Australian culture as it was developing, which is why it's still taught in schools to this day, even though much of it is as dull as bollocks. So that's what I did. I wrote poems. They weren't very good, but they always had a funny ending. And I wrote comics and drew my own comic about a group of cats that hung around the back of a hospital incinerator. It was disgusting, but fun. And I wrote songs when I was a teenager. And then when we moved to England, I wrote loads of short stories, tons and tons and tons of short stories. And then I got into acting, did a theatre degree, and became a playwright for a few years, and then stopped doing that and got back into writing stories and prose again.
So that's very interesting. So you've experimented with a lot of different mediums, and a lot of them obviously poetry and comic books as well, focus on crystallizing things, and kind of they're very short stories. They tend to be kind of very slim mediums, I suppose. How do you think that's affected your prose writing?
It's a it kind of makes prose writing more fun for me. I've always really admired poets. I'm not a good poet. I'm a sucky poet, but I really admire what poets do, which is to take these huge stories, and they can be giant stories about loss and betrayal and love and metaphysics. And I grew up with my dad reading me T.S. Eliot poems as a bedtime story and stuff. So seriously, true story, I'll tell you about that later. But yeah, The Hollow Men used to be like this regular bedtime story for me. And I really try to take what poets do, which is to take huge stories and crystallize them down to their finest form, to the most compact form, and put that in prose. And what that does is it gives the reader something to unpack. It gives them this gigantic universe in just a few words. So yeah, that's what I try and do.
Yeah, it's a lovely phrase, unpack. Going back to writing comic books, now you are one of the co-heads of Graphic Scotland, who are promoting comic books and graphic narrative in Scotland at the moment. Right, writing comics. Again, how would do you think that has influenced your prose writing at all?
It kind of unexpectedly influenced it a lot, because what writing for comics does is it forces you to think visually. So you think about what you want your audience to see, and you think about how you're going to play with the tension between what you're giving your audience to look at and what your characters are actually saying to one another. It forces you to think of your story sort of almost unit by unit. So you're kind of blocking your story as you go along, and you can immediately see, like quite literally see in your head, you can envision the backbone of your story and where it's falling down and where it's really holding up. It really helps you to trim all the fat off it. So yeah, writing for comics is something that you can translate to an awful lot of different mediums. So if you want to write for film or write for theatre, or indeed just, write for prose, it's a really brilliant way of learning to write collaboratively, because you're giving your script to someone else to read. And anything you do, even if you're writing short stories, if you're writing for an audience to stand up and just speak it, if you're writing a book, you need to give that to someone else to read, if it's an audience or an editor or what have you, however far it goes. So you learn not to be a selfish little hermit cooped up writing just for me. You kind of lose that mentality immediately. You're always going to think, what do I want them to see, and how do I want them to see it, and how can I make this as concise and unselfish as possible?
Okay, all right, going back to your development as a writer, obviously you're not from around here. You've traveled quite a lot.
I started in Queensland, so I moved from Townsville to Burpengary to Rockhampton, and then we moved from Rockhampton to Fiji. So we lived in Fiji for 3 years. We lived in Suva for a little bit, and then over in Pasifika Harbour, which is a little bit further around the coast of Viti Levu. And then we moved to the UK. We settled down near Middlesbrough, which was a disappointment. And then we took off to live in the Middle East for a bit. We lived in Abu Dhabi. My parents camped out there for about 10 years, but I came back to Edinburgh in the meantime to go to university. And I've been in Edinburgh ever since. So I completely fell in love with Edinburgh and decided it was where I wanted to be. So yeah, here I am, like 12 years later.
I'd just like to say that Elistink's views on Middlesbrough are not necessarily reflected in Ariadne Casmoran's views.
Oh
But
no. Riddles was really
okay.
cool, actually. It's got a great gay scene.
Oh. Everywhere it's got a great gay scene if you dig deep enough.
Yep. If you know which gentlemen's clubs to knock
Yes.
on, you can find some absolutely amazing lesbian bars. Yeah.
Wonderful. Okay, right. So you've traveled a lot. What do you think you can take from that to put into your writing?
Oh, lots of stuff. When you travel, you become very objective very quickly. You lose your country. You lose that sense of being able to go home. Like, you can go home, but you can't go home. There's a reason that's a saying. You really are kind of ripped away from any sense of being embedded in your wee cozy nest of cultural identity. You know, you begin to realize that you're an outsider everywhere you go, including your own country. And while that's a bit painful, it also gives you this marvelous sense of objectivity. So you do begin to view every culture you encounter as this beautiful thing that you're observing from the outside, that you can deconstruct and play with and have fun with and be outraged by and what have you. So yeah, objectivity and open-mindedness. The sense of real horror sometimes. You know, it sounds really glamorous and romantic to say, yes, I've traveled the world, but I've had some horrific experiences as well. So it really gives you a lot of material. And it gives you the kind of horrific experiences that a few years down the line turn into hilarious stories. But at the time are really terrible. But yeah, it's all good stories. Most of the time it's really funny stories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Performance. And performance praise is obviously what we do here at A List Inc. And I just thought I'd start on this subject by talking about, what do you think performance gives to prose that you wouldn't necessarily get it just reading it written down from a book? What do you think the audience gets out of it?
Oh, lots of stuff. Reading a story on the page and being an audience member of a live event is a very different kind of reading. I wouldn't necessarily say that one is better than the other. When you're in a room with a really good storyteller, there's something so thrilling about a live performance, about having someone who's right in front of you, someone you can reach out and touch. I mean, that's why theatre is so fantastic sometimes, and which is why storytelling is usually just wonderful. It's a wonderful thing to be in a room with someone who has you in the palm of their hand. So yeah, it's an amazing thing to be in an audience with someone who really knows what they're doing, you know, where you're just leaning forward thinking, you know, what's going to happen next? You know, this is... It can be a really wonderful thing. It can also be a dreadful thing if you're in a room with a dreadful storyteller that you can't escape from, and you're in the middle of the row, and if you got up and left at that very second to pretend you had to go to the toilet, but really you're getting your coat and you're going to walk out the door, you know, and, oh, it's all very bad. You know, sometimes it's a bad thing, sometimes it's a good thing. It's the same with all live performance, really. It's just a different kind of reading. You know, reading a story in the page is not the same as, you know, the reading experience you get as part of a live performance. Doesn't make one better than the other.
Okay. So you've recently come off, I think it was a 3-year stint as a ghost tours.
More like 10 years. Now, hang on, let me think.
Geez.
Hang on a sec, let me think. I just think of it as 10 years. It isn't. It's more like, when did I start? Okay, it's 7 years.
Okay.
7 years.
Shall I rephrase the question?
No.
Okay.
I did ghost tours for about 7 years. Maybe 8 years. No, it's 8 years. Shit. Oh, that means I'm older than I thought it was. Okay. Ghost tours. It is not a profession that's generally very seriously taken, but you're telling stories in all weather. You're just from a theatrical skills point of view, you have to tell stories outside, which means your projection, your skills of projection have to be outstanding, and they have to become outstanding very, very quickly if you begin your career as a ghost tour guide with no projection skills. You have to be able to know how to talk for hours on end without screwing up your vocal cords, and you have to remember to eat. You have to be able to tell serious stories, sad stories, historical stories, and ghost stories to drunks, foreign students, tourists in general, people who aren't very interested, people who've been dragged along to the ghost tour because their wives or their husbands made them, people who feel they've paid too much for the ghost tour because inflation is now horrific and everyone's competing with one another, so now ghost tours are more expensive than they really should be. You know, you have to be able to tell stories to all sorts of different folk at any given time. And what that teaches you to do is to be able to handle any situation, be able to handle talking to the police, be able to handle someone who needs to be kicked off, be able to handle entire groups of school children who don't speak your language, who you now have to speak to for an hour and a half in English. It teaches you all sorts of amazing stuff. And I learned, you know, pretty much by the end of it, I learned to tell people stories which were so scary that they fainted, or which were so frightening that they genuinely came out in welts and burns because they believed that there was a poltergeist in the same room as them and they were having a massive psychosomatic reaction. It's the best training ground ever. So by comparison, telling a story in the storytelling centre, it's inside, it's indoors. You're telling a lovely, funny story with a group of other comedians who pat you on the back afterwards and say that was lovely. Which never happens with a ghost tour because, it just it's you're alone. So it's a much more comforting thing to tell stories. With storytelling gigs or with spoken word gigs where there's that sense of camaraderie and loveliness, it's not as hard.
If you were to give a tip to a novice performer with your years of performing experience, and it was a really useful one but could be summarized quite quickly, what would it be?
Remember to breathe and remember to slow down. If you've written your story well, every word will already have been given some weight. You will have already trimmed all the fat. You'll edit really quickly while you're standing up reading it out. If you have got fat, you'll just edit as you go and just drop it as you go. But just slow down and enunciate every single word, and you'll be okay. The audience needs to be able to hear you, and you need to give every word the respect it deserves. And then you'll be grand. You're just reading a story, yeah? Nothing hard about that.
If you could name one essential trait that all writers need, which one would you plump for?
You have to sincerely believe that writing is the most fun you can ever have. If you have the joy of writing, everything else will follow. The motivation, the desire to do it every day, the motivation to get out and network, blah, 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 blah. All that stuff. All the mechanical, logistical stuff that comes with the business of actually being a writer, if you've got the joy and if you really believe that that's what gives you that kind of intense joy that's a bit feels a bit naughty to describe, that kind of really good joy, that's all you need.
Okay, we're getting to kind of the wrapping up stages here. So, just as a kind of default end question, can you tell us something that we don't already know?
You might know this if you're Scottish. I don't know if this is ever taught generally in Scottish schools, but in Australia, a lot of people were sent over as convicts, and a lot of them were sent over for really spurious reasons. So spurious that it makes me think that perhaps the British government was simply trying to clear out the undesirables, the working classes,
The Irish.
the Irish.
Yeah.
Which means, I know one of my ancestors was indeed Irish and was exported to Australia for helping a friend to steal a cow. He was caught hiding the cow in his backyard toilet, and was discovered by the police because his ass was sticking out the other end. He was just not a particularly brilliant criminal. There's
Please tell me
another.
that's in your memoir. Some brilliant image there, lovely.
So there's another bloke, right, who was sent out from Newcastle for stealing a ball of string. We actually have the bit of paper that says, so and so sent out for stealing string. Silly, silly reasons. So the only government which sent out genuine, hardened, really, really badass criminals was Scotland. So in Australia, if you were sitting in a convict camp and you heard that there was a Scot coming to join your cell, you shat yourself because the Scots were psychopaths. Which is lovely. I like to think that there's a little bit of a Scottish psychopath in all us Australians.
And on that note,
So
I think we should
there
be wrapping up. Okay, thank you very much.
go. You're very welcome. Thank you.
And that's all from A List Stinks Tales from the Script this month. Many thanks to you for listening, and many thanks to our guest, Ariadne Casmoran. Don't forget that if you want to learn anything more about us or upcoming gigs, you can check us out at our website at alistink.net. I've been Tom Moore, and I hope very much to be speaking at you again soon. Bye bye.